Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell. And as we promised last week, we're going to revisit with Professor Andy Ingersoll from California Institute of Technology, famous Caltech. And he's a professor there of planetary science. And we had an interesting discussion last week about various aspects of climate on the various different solar system planets. But today we would like to sort of go back a little bit and do two concentrations. One, I think we'd like to learn a little bit about how on earth do these planets form. Some of us think we know, but we have the expert on the line. And so, Andy Ingersoll, why don't you start today with just telling us a little bit about sort of what I might call Planetary Science 101. How do the planets form in the first place?
How do the planets form? Good question. Well, how do we know how they formed? No one was there to write it down and tell us. Well, there's several ways. One is that if with radioactive decay of the elements, we can date most of the solar system formed at about the same time. That's 4.5 billion years ago. So we know from the radioactive dating of meteorites and the Earth itself that everything formed within a few within a million years, really, of itself. And that a million years is a very short time relative to 4.5 billion years. The other way we know how the solar system formed is from looking at other stars. Other stars, when they're very young, a few million years old, have disks of dust and gases surrounding the stars. And those disks go away after a few million years. And we think that that's because the dust and gases clump together to form planets. The solar system formed at the same time the sun formed, and there was some junk left over that didn't get incorporated into the sun, and that became the planets.
And that became us.
Yeah.
And the gravity of the sun just made sure that we circulated around in our various types of orbit. But as a chemist, I will immediately then think, well, that's very interesting. Does that mean then the further away from the sun that you get, there's an enrichment of the lighter isotopes, and that can be, therefore, a proving point.
Absolutely. You're very good. You get a pass on this course.
Great.
The objects in close to the sun, like Mercury and all the terrestrial planets, have been cooked, and they've lost their volatile elements. We don't have very much water even though you think the oceans are pretty deep. And then as you go farther away, the cooking was less, and so the objects farther away from the sun have more of these lighter and more volatile elements.
Well, hang on. Then that means that further out from us, there are planets, our own little famous planets, that have a lot of water then on that basis. Is that correct?
There are certainly are planets with a lot of water. It may not be in liquid form. On the other hand, Jupiter, for instance, probably, and Saturn and so on, they probably have a lot of water. In fact, Uranus and Neptune may be mostly water, water and hydrogen gas. But it's probably too warm to be liquid out there because the water is down in the cores where it's still hot.
And so what's the outside temperature of those planets?
Oh, boy. It's very cold. I'll give it to you in kelvins. It's,
yes.
Average outer planet, giant planet is 100 kelvins, even less for Uranus and Neptune.
Okay, so it's nippy.
Minus 200 Celsius.
Right. Yeah. Getting close. So there are no planets, to your knowledge, then, where there is what we would recognize as water in a liquid form. Is that what you're saying?
Well, the moons of some of the giant planets are covered with water ice, and there's evidence that there's liquid water down below those icy crusts, and the evidence is complicated. One moon of Saturn called Enceladus is spewing out water vapor plumes, kind of like water vapor volcanoes, and some of the other moons seem to have the magnetic signatures of a salty water underneath. So down below the icy crust, there may be liquid water.
So that's Enceladus. That's a wonderful name. And I think where do these names come from, as a matter of fact? That's an interesting question.
Mythology of many of them, Greek mythology, but everyone's trying to be politically correct, and we have name banks for new objects and new volcanoes, and we're can't name them after our favorite dog or anything.
Quite the reverse. We name our dogs after these various moons. I mean, tell me, Enceladus. My Greek mythology is rather lacking.
I don't know exactly who Enceladus was, but I think it was a he, and I think he was associated with Saturn in some way, because, after all, it's the moon of Saturn.
All right. So anyway, this has got geysers, whichever, which are spewing out what seems to be salt water. So now tell me, what other ingredients are there on Enceladus, and does that mean we might find little life forms that we're accustomed to, some little bacteria or something like that?
Well, there's methane, carbon dioxide, coming out of these geysers, and there's water, as I said. So you do have organic molecules, and you do have water, and where you have water, you have the possibility of oxygen.
And we don't obviously have particularly high noxious temperatures. I mean, it seems
the surface of Enceladus is 200 degrees Celsius below zero, so
right.
It's incredibly inhospitable.
Right,
but down below, if you could drill 10 kilometers or 50 kilometers down through the icy crust, you might find liquid water. And then if you have that water in contact with warm rock, then you have the possibility of chemical reactions. And chemical reactions means energy, and that's really what life needs, is the basic ingredients plus an energy source.
So let me go back for the one last time to these geysers. When they're sending up their plumes, then it's obviously freezing immediately. So you just see this beautiful plume of snow and ice falling then. Is that what you – can we actually see that with our telescopes?
Absolutely. Snow and ice, and we can detect the vapor as well.
I would love to have a photograph of that if you could direct us later on after the program. That just sounds like it's wonderful. Let's return then a little bit to this Planetary Science 101. Is it taken for granted, or am I wrong, that all of the moons of the various planets are offshoots from those particular planets? Or am I incorrect? They've just captured some moon as it went by in a long-distant past.
Another good question. The moons close to the planets are apparently formed at the same time the planets did, kind of the way the planets formed around the sun. They were originally just a cloud of gas and dust, and then they clumped themselves together to form moons, in this case, are orbiting the planets. And those moons are distinct because they're in nice circular orbits. They're all in the same plane, which is the equatorial plane of the planet. But then you have another class of moons that are on big, loopy orbits much farther out. The orbits are tilted at various angles. And those are probably captured asteroids or captured comets or something that came along later.
So anything that's sort of circulating a planet is by definition of moon. That's the first point.
Anything that's that travels around the sun with the planet is a moon. But some of the moons were captured later, and some formed out of the debris.
And presumably, some of those moons are quite large on our scale. I mean, for example, going back to this Enceladus. How big is it?
It's a rather small moon. 500 kilometers in radius, which makes it
quite tiny.
A lot smaller than our moon. There are moons out there that are a good deal bigger than our moon, Titan being a very large moon of Saturn that has lakes of methane and rivers of methane and all sorts of interesting stuff.
So if it has lakes and rivers of methane, obviously, again, it's cold, but do they have storms like we do? And we've got lakes and rivers of water, so there must be some weather system there which is alien to our own weather, but with the same principles?
Yeah, pretty much the same principles. It's just that it's too cold out there to have water. Water is present, but it's all hard as rock. It's hard frozen ice. But you take what we think of as a gas, natural gas, and you cool it down to minus 200 Celsius, and it becomes a liquid. And so you can have methane weather.
Can you get lightning?
Well, and then we've not seen lightning on Titan. That's right. We've seen it on Jupiter and Saturn, and it's probably associated with water clouds on those planets. But on Titan, no lightning so far.
And of course, I was going to think that therefore it should catch fire, but of course I forgot. You're supposed to have oxygen. That's chemistry 101.
That's right. Oxygen would be an explosive gas on Saturn.
That would be interesting. Tell me, there's some other features then. I mean, if we're having sort of rainfall and thunderstorms and ice of methane, are there any more unusual weather features out there that you could regale us with somewhere in the planetary system?
Oh, boy. Well, we have a hexagon cloud on Saturn, a huge thing. Well, it's bigger than two Earths. And it's sort of locked onto the North Pole, and it was discovered by Voyager in the early 80s. So it's a 30-year-old, at least 30-year-old hexagon. And what it really is a instead of a river of gas, a jet stream, in other words, going around following a circle at one particular latitude, it doesn't follow a circle. It sort of meanders in and out towards the pole and away from the pole and towards the pole. And it's got six sides, and it's at least 30 years old.
Are there models to understand how that forms? I mean, when it was discovered, I'm sure people were a bit mesmerized. You know, what's a hexagon doing out?
Yes, definitely. Whenever you have an interesting observation, you'll have theoreticians rushing in to explain it, and sometimes all the theories agree with each other, and sometimes you get several theories that differ and still come up with at least seem to
a plausible answer.
Yeah. But jet streams on the Earth and in the oceans, they meander back and forth, and rivers meander. So it's possible to find analogs, and it's possible to find models. Simulations on a computer that lead to permanent wave-like jets. So we sort of understand it in a little fashion.
That's good. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Professor Andy Ingersoll, Caltech Professor of Planetary Science. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Niesel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. I think everybody can relate to this. How many times have you gone to a buffet, stuffed yourself, and promised not to do it again, only to do it again? And you wonder why I can't control myself?
Because your second brain is working against you. I'm talking about the enteric nervous system, or ENS, a complex nervous system that spans your gastrointestinal tract.
Like the brain, the neurons in these organs produce neurotransmitters that can impact your mood. So when you eat rich, fatty foods, the gut detects those molecules, stimulating the ENS to send pleasure signals to your brain. Another reason why we break our diets.
You're fighting against the 500 million neurons that make up the ENS, which isn't much compared to the brain's 90 billion neurons, but it's the only nervous system outside the brain that's capable of extensive, local, independent function.
We know from studies the neurons in the ENS produce as much dopamine as the brain. Dopamine is key to our feelings of pleasure and reward. Most of the body's serotonin is made there. Serotonin promotes happy feelings and helps regulate sleep, appetite, temperature, and repairs damaged cells.
You may be wondering about stress, since that always makes me eat. Well, there are clear connections between the ENS and stress. Stress in the brain triggers the production of a gastrointestinal hormone called ghrelin. This hormone kickstarts hunger, which lowers our feelings of anxiety and depression.
The downside is studies show stressed-out mice tend to seek out fatty foods, which is directly related to the elevated production of ghrelin. We see a clear connection between chronic stress and obesity.
I've got to stop thinking with my stomach so much. We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell here with Andrew Ingersoll, Professor of Planetary Science at Caltech. And we're talking about weather patterns on some of the other planets, the solar planets. But let's, if we could, for the last 10 or so minutes, let's go back to the one planet that sort of really people get really interested in because, A, it's one of the brighter and it's nice and red, the red planet, Mars. Tell us a little bit about Mars, Andy. What's your particular fascination by that planet compared to, say, the others? What does its unique properties have from your point of view?
Well, Mars has the advantage, as far as exploration is concerned, of roughly transparent atmosphere, so you can see down to the ground. And yet it does have an atmosphere, so it has weather and clouds and ice caps that grow and shrink with the seasons. It also has intriguing surface features that suggest that liquid water or some liquid flowed there, and so that makes Mars kind of a candidate for looking for life or evidence of past life. But even then, it's a great puzzle because here we have evidence of water having flowed on the surface in the early history of the solar system, and yet the astronomers tell us the sun was fainter during the early part of the solar system. So we have the faint young sun paradox. So why was it warm and wet on Mars when the sun was colder and fainter?
Oh, I hadn't heard of that before. Pursue that a little bit. What are the two counteracting theories?
Well, either we're somehow misinterpreting the astronomical data about how stars get brighter as they age, or there's something we don't understand about Mars. And I tend to believe the astronomers because they have billions of stars to look at, and we only have one Mars, and it's actually a greater puzzle.
Well, since we've been sending things up to Mars, some of them successfully, some not so, well, what are the really major discoveries that you think we've made in the last, say, 25, 30 years?
Well, I think the evidence of past liquid water is profound. You know, it comes from different directions. One is the surface features, the flow features. Other is the chemical features. We find basically salts left over from some ocean. There was salty ocean that's now dry, and there's rounded boulders that indicate streams that ground sharp edges off. And,
all right.
And then there's little ripple marks, and there's strata that look like lake bed strata and Grand Canyon kind of strata.
Oh, so everything is there except the liquid water.
We don't see the liquid water today.
But you do see the ice caps. I mean, that is water, or is that something?
Oh, there's, the ice caps are certainly partly water and partly carbon dioxide, dry ice. So you have two kinds of ice caps. The ice and the dry ice are mixed together on Mars. But we have evidence of liquid water, but no strong evidence of liquid water today.
Tell us about this other conundrum. We briefly touched upon it, and if you don't want to, we can pass on. But what's your take on these current theories that the average temperature on Mars is increasing, similar to that we are seeing here on the Earth?
I personally think it's far too early or premature to say that Mars is warming up or cooling down. It's a very difficult measurement.
Well, how do you measure that? Is that
well? You know, we have infrared telescopes, and they measure temperatures. That's what the infrared does. But, they don't last forever. You put up a spacecraft, and it has an infrared device on board, and it measures temperatures, and then the spacecraft dies, and you put a new one up, and you have to calibrate the instrument, and it's a different instrument. So you expect certain uncertainties, and there's really no good evidence that Mars' climate is changing. It's all just speculation, and I think it's just premature to draw any conclusions
okay.
from that.
So then we can, in fact, then from your point of view, I know you're a planetary scientist, and, well, the Earth is a planet. Talk to us a little bit about your understanding of our global warming, our planetary warming.
Well, unfortunately, it's going to happen, and it is happening. The signal of global warming is just now, over the last couple of decades, it's been rising up over the climate noise. And right now, the signal...
Sorry, what do you mean by climate noise?
Well, obviously, each year is a little different from the year before, and that's just the fluctuations in the weather, the natural variability of the weather. And that's what I'm calling the noise. Now, you have to find some trend superposed on those fluctuations before you can declare that we've seen global warming directly. But it's now becoming more and more obvious, especially in the polar regions. And in addition, we understand the weather. We can simulate it. We can forecast it. The forecasts are getting better and better. And so our understanding of the weather very confidently tells us that unless we somehow shut down CO2 production or accumulation, it's going to get warmer.
So there's no ambiguity in your planetary science mind that the CO2 and the warming are directly related?
Right. I'd say my only caveat is that the signal to noise is still not overwhelming. It's you see the evidence in the Arctic that it's warming up, and the shipping lanes are opening up in the Arctic Ocean, all these things, and you can't deny that stuff.
I don't know. So I mean, but that's nothing to do with CO2 per se.
Well, yes, it is, because
okay.
CO2 traps the heat. Mm-hmm. The heat warms the oceans and the ground, and so it gets warmer.
But if you warm the oceans also, then you sort of begin to release extra CO2. So this is it's not just a one-on-one relationship. There's also many features that come into this.
Yeah, we call them feedbacks.
Right. And these aren't very, they're positive in one sense. Let me ask you a sort of more philosophical and sort of ethical question. There are people who say, and I suppose it's a sensible approach, actually. It says, look, if we are suffering from global warming today, then it behooves us to find a way to deal with it. There's two ways to deal with it, try to stop it or to live with it. And stopping it seems to be extremely complicated, if even possible. I somehow doubt it is. Even if we stopped using petroleum carbon-based materials and stopped creating our own anthropogenic CO2, we wouldn't do very much at the moment for the next 100 years to reduce the global warming. So therefore, we should find a way to live with it. And therefore, that means, I suppose, population movements, agricultural changes, going from where you can produce things to where you can't now into the future. That's changing the nature of this planet completely, in a sense, right?
It certainly is. I mean, some of those things you mentioned are, I think, politically and economically just unfeasible. We can't move populations around. People will move where they want to, and if they're starving in one place, they'll move to another place, and there'll be wars, and it won't be pleasant.
Can you see a pleasant, organized outcome for the global warming that you and most of your colleagues in planetary science and climate predict?
It's sort of a grim pleasantness. When the signs of global warming really become clear, and where real problems are resulting from global warming, I think people will reluctantly and slowly take action. But right now, it's too far in the future, and it doesn't affect us directly. No one has died from global warming, and the climate deniers will be able to say, well, it's not happening. But they're wrong, and they'll be proven wrong, but it's so far in the future that I won't be around to laugh at them.
No, but I mean, they're already. I heard on the news today, you know, this group of Eskimo Native Americans up, or Native Canadians, Native Continental Americans anyway, who are moving from their island habitat because the island is being submerged, and it's going, and they're leaving. They have to.
Right.
So it's happening, but only to people that really don't command much press, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think people do, you know, the human race muddles through so far, and I think people will take action when it becomes serious and when it affects a large number of, unfortunately, rich people who have the means to take action. Okay. So it's, you know, that's the only optimism, is that it'll get bad enough so that people will make it better.
Or at least live with it in the most equitable manner that you can. Let's just go back to Mars just for one finishing comment. We've been doing Science Studio for 20, 25 years, I think. And from way back, you know, one of the things that's always the most intriguing to people is this business of life elsewhere. Right. And the fact that, you know, Mars is this close and it has the water and it has the possibility. And in fact, I think some recent analyses showed the presence of phosphorus and nitrogen materials. What's your sort of prediction about life in other locations?
I'd give life, finding fossil life, evidence of past life on Mars, I'd give it a 50-50 chance at most. I think the discovery of planets around other stars, and of course there are billions of them, and there's billions of planets around other stars. That's what we get by extrapolating where we're at now. Eventually, we're going to find evidence of life. I don't know how we're going to find it because the stars are so far away, but I think the evidence of life out in the universe or out in the galaxy is overwhelming now. I wouldn't call it evidence. I'd call it probability.
Right, based upon the evidence that we built up from our analyses.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe there's another Science Studio program out there. Maybe that's, we'll get radio signals from
you
these people.
You can get other, you can get other people to do that one.
Andy Ingersoll, Professor of Planetary Science, California Institute of Technology. It's been absolutely delightful talking to you for these last couple of programs. I don't hesitate to say sometime in the near future when we get some really paralyzing information from outer space, we're going to do another program.
My pleasure.
And thank you so much to Norma Martinez for putting it together, another space buff, I might add. And we'll be back next week with another Science Studio. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Albert DiRienzo of New York has been recruited to El Paso to oversee the new Biomedical Institute of the Americas. The institute is a nonprofit subsidiary of the Medical Center of the Americas Foundation. Al DiRienzo will lead the institute toward its goal of moving medical research from the laboratory bench side to the bedside of patients. Read more at the Region's Life Sciences News Digest. Go to mcasynapse.org.